Welcome and thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. This week, Congress held a first-of-its-kind hearing on Medicare for All in the House Rules Committee. NAHU has been closely monitoring efforts to enact single-payer legislation at both the federal and state levels, and on this week's episode, NAHU's Marcy Buckner recaps the hearing and the next steps in the debate over Medicare for All. And beyond the federal legislation, we'll also take a deep dive at state-level efforts, including Washington State, as it mulls implementing a public option. Before we begin, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify, and to rate us. The podcast is posted every Friday on these platforms ahead of being distributed through NAHU's member-exclusive health policy newsletter, The Washington Update, giving you a head start on your weekly healthcare happy hour. The big whoop this week was the hearing in the House Rules Committee on Medicare for All. We previewed this last week, and we'll get into the details throughout today's discussion. But Marcy, what was your main takeaway from the hearing?
One of the main takeaways I felt was hearing from the witnesses and realizing something that we talk about quite often when we say that there are these misconceptions of what Medicare for All means versus single payer versus universal health care. And we oftentimes criticize that these terms are being used interchangeably and they all mean different things. And I found that the witnesses, as they are experts in their fields, we did see them using those words interchangeably. And it just goes to show just how much more we need to work to educate not only members of Congress, but also those in the public, that there's a difference between universal health care and Medicare for All. Universal health care just means that everyone has access to care. Medicare for All means that we're using the Medicare system to deliver care to the citizens of the country. Single payer is using one, probably government-run system to be able to deliver that care. Then there's also the Medicare buy-in, which allows certain populations to be able to buy in and use and take advantage of the Medicare system while still preserving a private market. Where sometimes the witnesses were referring to these plans interchangeably, we also saw that there was a recognition of possibly having to start at one point with a possible Medicare buy-in or something like that, and then move to Medicare for All. So there was some recognition that there's a difference in some of these systems, but we did see them using those words interchangeably, which I think is very confusing to the media that's covering the hearing and the members of Congress that are there trying to learn more about this really important topic.
The six-hour hearing included testimony from a range of stakeholders covering a lot of issues with Medicare for All, including cost, choice, coverage, quality, and access to care. How did NAHU help to shape these conversations, and how were these issues ultimately discussed?
We helped to shape these conversations by, one, submitting our own written testimony, which you'll be able to read in the Washington Update, as well as signing on with many of our coalition partners to written testimony that they submitted. So working alongside the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future, which opposes Medicare for All, and the Partnership for Employer-Sponsored Coverage, which obviously also has a huge interest in opposing Medicare for All. Some of the things that we heard during the hearing, and specifically from members of Congress when they were asking questions of the witnesses, were pieces that were in our testimony, asking about who would lose care under a Medicare for All plan, how this plan would transition, what happens to employer-sponsored coverage. These were all things that we pointed out as being huge deterrents to this proposal, that there would be a huge increase in cost. So some of the witnesses, when they were talking about this and when they were receiving questions from members of Congress were asking, under this Medicare for All plan, what happens to premiums? How much is this going to cost? And the witnesses, for the most part, were saying the premiums are going to go away because this is going to be paid by taxes. So how does that add up? They also were saying, what happens to employer-sponsored coverage? Well, that's also going to go away. And so instead of paying into a benefit plan as an employer, they would then be paying in taxes towards a Medicare for All. But then individuals would be taxed as well. And I think at one point, Ranking Member Cole mentioned that Medicare for All would cost more than $32 trillion over 10 years and stressed that doubling both individual and corporate taxes would not be sufficient to cover this cost. So this is something that we have pointed out several times, and we were able to see with the ranking member pointing out just how expensive this would be. I think also thinking about the shift of the employer cost towards benefit designs and benefit plans then being shifted into taxes, I think we think then about those employees. They're not going to have their choice of coverage that they had under employer-sponsored care, but they're also then going to be losing a huge benefit in their employment. I doubt we're going to see employers replacing that with an increase in their income, and then the individuals are going to be taxed in order to provide towards the cost for Medicare for All. So we're really struggling to see how all of this literally adds up. Another challenge in trying to determine exactly how much this was going to cost to put into place is that the estimates from the economists that were on the witness stand were using the 2017 Sanders bill in order to estimate the costs. This current Medicare for All bill has not been scored by the Congressional Budget Office, so we don't know exactly how much it's going to cost. So that $32 trillion over 10 years is from an older bill for Medicare for All that did not include some of the new benefits that are in this bill. This bill in the House includes the addition of long-term care to be provided by Medicare for All, which I'm sure you can imagine would be an astronomical cost to add to how much this is going to cost in increase in taxes across the board. So we have to be careful about that. Members of Congress were also looking at not just what is new in this bill compared to the 2017 Sanders bill, but also looking at a comparison between this bill and the Affordable Care Act. So keeping in mind, and some of the witnesses pointed this out, the Affordable Care Act hasn't been fully implemented the way that it was written. There have been challenges in the courts. Medicaid expansion has not been adopted in all of the states. There's the cut off of the CSR funding, which has led to increase in silver plans or silver loading, as we call it. And so it's hard to really compare what we're seeing with what has happened with the ACA with shifting towards this Medicare for All piece. Other members of Congress pointed out aspects of the Affordable Care Act that the Democrats really held as firm standpoints in the bill that would be completely taken away under the Medicare for All piece. And one of those things is employer-sponsored coverage. Representative Burgess, who is a past recipient of the NAHU Spirit of Independence Award, pointed out that the ACA requires employer coverage through the employer mandate. And so why now are we looking at a plan, a Medicare for All plan, that would take away that option for employers to provide coverage? I thought that was a really important point to bring up and also to show really the stark contrast between what we have with the Affordable Care Act, the increase in access that it's allowed for people across the country, and then comparing it to this plan for Medicare for All. Employer-sponsored coverage was a large part of this discussion, and there were obviously witnesses on both sides of this issue and the importance of employer-sponsored coverage versus allowing a Medicare for All plan. And some brought up the burden on employers and how difficult it is oftentimes for employers to be compliant with the ACA and the employer mandate, as well as trying to find the right plan for their employees. One witness even brought up the additional expense of having to use a broker to determine what plan is right for your employees and using a broker to be in compliance as an employer. What I thought was interesting about this is that where he's pointing out the additional expense of a broker, where we know for the most part commissions are baked in, as we say, to the premium, although we do have some instances where brokers work on a fee plan. But for the most part, it's not an additional expense that's put into the premium, although an employer may choose to contract with a broker to provide other services. When we look at this Medicare for All aspect and the taxes that are going to be put in place because of that, I like to think of the expenses that businesses use for a CPA to do their taxes. They're already doing that now, and they're going to have to continue that and be even more careful and diligent about their taxes. And there's going to be bureaucracy and administrative burdens on the employers with however they structure the taxes under the Medicare for All plan. So I don't really think that doing away with employer-sponsored coverage is really a way of saying that this is lifting a burden from employers.
Can you talk a little bit about the politics of having the hearing, particularly how Democrats decided to hold a hearing in the first place, and where their caucus is on the issue now that it's being debated in Congress?
Yes, as you mentioned, there was a lot of politics behind having this hearing, specifically in the Rules Committee. This is something that Congressman Burgess brought up, as well as some others, being really concerned that this was not something that was put in for a hearing with the traditional committee of jurisdiction for health issues, health insurance issues, and that this was put into the Rules Committee. And some really feel like this was a way of trying to maneuver around different logistics within Congress about the rules of having hearings in order to even have this take place. Some are pointing fingers at Nancy Pelosi. She even stopped by at the beginning of the hearing to kind of wish them well. So there are a lot of criticisms in how this came about. However, Chairman McGovern, when asked about this and when this was pointed out and whether this was a manipulation of the system, said that the Rules Committee is one of the longest standing committees in Congress and that it is only right and very much under the rules of committee hearings to be able to have the hearing there. So there is kind of a dual position on how this was brought about and how it came to be in front of the Rules Committee for a hearing.
While this was the first ever hearing on Medicare for All, it is sure not to be the last. What can we expect in the near future and in this session of Congress on single payer?
It is sure not to be the last of hearings for Medicare for All. I agree with that. And throughout the conversations in the hearing, and especially when they were talking about the controversy over having the hearing in the Rules Committee, there was a challenge amongst both the majority and minority members on the committee to other committees to have hearings. So to send this over to the Health Committee for them to have a hearing and for others to have hearings on Medicare for All and what it's going to mean to the economy and the health of the country. And I think there's also a focus and kind of a side eye over to the Senate. So you'll notice that this committee hearing was in the House. And that is very much because the Democrats have the majority in the House. They are chairing the committees in the House, and so they're able to put together the docket. They're also able to have more witnesses at the hearings. So you'll hear a little bit different from a committee depending on who is in the majority. And over on the Senate side, the Republicans have the majority, and Mitch McConnell has said he does not want to address any overwhelming healthcare issues until after the 2020 elections. So that gives us a clear indication that we're not likely to see any hearings on the Senate side, but we are probably going to see more hearings on the House side, not only to kind of smooth out some of the ruffled feathers from having this first hearing in the Rules Committee and not in a committee of jurisdiction for healthcare, but also because the Democrats are going to want to continue to get their message out about Medicare for All. However, the Democratic caucus is kind of unsteady on where they are with Medicare for All. They currently have 237 members in the House. It takes 218 to get anything passed in the House. So they have a majority to be able to pass something if they all vote on party lines. But the Democratic Party is very fractured, especially on this issue. There are over 40 new members of Congress that are Democrats that won in heavy Republican areas. And many of them see this issue as being something that would prevent them from maintaining their seat, so that if they supported a Medicare for All proposal, their reelection would very much be up for grabs. So I think there are a lot of Democrats that will feel very uncomfortable voting for a Medicare for All proposal. They'll talk about it in a hearing and they'll bring up a lot of these points, but we're not going to get it to a floor vote. It's not going to move any further than that within this congressional session. Also, kind of looking into the future, there was a question about how a transition like this would take place. And this is something that within the bill talks about a 2-year transition to go from our current system to a Medicare for All system. And the witnesses were all very concerned about the tight turnaround, although some witnesses said this is something that was needed 2 and 20 years ago and not 2 years from now. It needs to happen now. Others were citing the transition time that it took for the Affordable Care Act. And I think we all saw how bumpy that transition was. And so that 2 years really isn't long enough for this transition. Because keep in mind, it's not just a transition off of employer-sponsored care to Medicare for All. It's an expansion of the Medicare system. It's taking folks that are on Medicare Advantage off of their plans, going into a strict Medicare plan. It's taking those on Medicaid and CHIP off of their plans, going into a Medicare plan. It's also restructuring the way that physicians and hospitals are reimbursed. And there's a large concern, especially from members of Congress in rural areas. Many of them brought this up, that with the lowering or potential lowering of reimbursement rates in some of those rural areas, and really it would be across the country, but because there's a lack of access to providers in rural areas, that with a lower reimbursement rate, they may see hospitals closing that just financially can't keep their doors open. So there's all of these pieces to also take into consideration when you're thinking about a transition. There's all of these different aspects of Medicare for All that would have to be addressed, and 2 years really may not be enough.
Beyond Congress, single payer and its variations are also being debated throughout the country, with several states considering legislation to enact a public option or similar programs. Can you give us a snapshot on where these bills are, both in terms of what they would do and in their chances of taking effect?
We've seen an increase in interest in these types of single-payer or Medicaid buy-ins across the country in the different states. And you'll notice I'm not saying a Medicare buy-in. These would have to be Medicaid buy-ins for state-by-state, or a single-payer system, or a public option, which, of course, as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, are all different things. What we have seen so far, and I think we've mentioned this earlier in previous podcasts, where New Mexico got very close to a Medicaid buy-in, having that passed in their House and Senate. But at the end, it was just too costly and burdensome for them to be able to get through before the end of their legislative session. We're seeing other states getting really close to having these proposals introduced. New York is one that's had a single-payer provision introduced every year since 1994. This is the first year that it's getting so close that they think it may pass, and all eyes are on the governor to what he will do, especially with the possibility of future political aspects on the part of the governor in New York. California, of course, they are looking at expanding access with the goal of universal coverage in their state, which again, remember, universal coverage just means that everyone has access to health insurance coverage. And then Washington State is the most recent to have a significant action. Actually, just over this past weekend, Washington State, paralleling what's happening here in Washington, D.C., also had some changes going on. And theirs was more than just a hearing, though. In Washington State, the legislature passed a bill to create standardized health plans in the exchange. and what attempts to establish a new public option. And I know a lot of people are concerned about hearing how this is going to play out in Washington State. Keep in mind, the governor still has to sign the bill. He hasn't done so yet, although he also has some larger political aspirations and so may use this as a bargaining chip for a national platform. So we are waiting for Governor Inslee to sign this and for funding to be implemented for this. And that has to be appropriated by the state by the end of June, or this whole provision will be completely nullified. So we still need the governor's signature and we still need the state legislature to act to fund this. However, what's included in this act is the inclusion of standardized plans in the state exchange by 2021. And some people might be concerned about hearing that. Standardized plans also might sound familiar to some people, and that's because there are several states that have standardized plans, including Washington, D.C., and this isn't necessarily something that's bad. Oftentimes, exchanges have put these in place as a way to make it easier for plans to be compared by consumers, and it's just requiring that in these standardized plans, everything is kind of listed out equally across the middle plans. So like I said, it's easier for consumers to be able to kind of determine the difference between these. The difference for Washington is that all of the insurance carriers currently offering plans in the exchange will be required to offer a similar metal level plan in the standard plan by 2021. They can continue to offer their non-standardized plans, but they have to offer a standardized plan. And as they are putting these together, there is a future aspect. They will be studying the standardized plans between 2021 and 2025, and the state insurance commissioner, or the authority, is to put together a report to the legislature about the impact of offering only standard plans starting in 2025. So that's really where we get to the point where this would transition into a true public option if only those standardized plans were offered through the exchanges, because there would be a requirement that the state authority would contract with at least one insurance carrier, so single carrier, but at least one, it could be more, with the goal of insuring at least one of the state contracted plan options for each county, and that starts in 2021. The plans that the authority would contract with would have a higher standard than those otherwise offered, including a more robust contracting process, a direct negotiation, and also looking at things more closely with the plan's rate, utilization management, pharmaceutical costs, all of these things. And that's where we really transition into, like I said, this becoming more of a public option, because although there are private carriers, the state would be contracting with them to offer these standard plans. There's also concern in Washington State because it would change the reimbursement rates. So those providers in the standard plans would be reimbursed a certain percentage of Medicare, and they'd be capped at how much they'd be able to charge within the carrier networks. Providers would not be required to participate in the standardized plans, but it seems as though they are worried about some providers being pressured to do so, although they would not be required to participate in the public plan, and carriers could not prevent a provider from participating in their carrier off of these standardized plans just because a provider didn't want to participate in the standardized plans. They would also be looking at expanding the availability of premium subsidies, and so raising the cap on eligibility from 400 to 500%. So they're also increasing the ability of folks to receive subsidies for the exchange, both for standardized and non-standardized plans. I know I spent a lot of time talking about Washington State. I wanted to make sure that we focused on it because it is going to be in the news a lot over the next couple of weeks, especially as we wait for the governor's signature. It would be the first of its type if it is implemented, and that's because this is a public option. We did see Vermont pass their single-payer provision several years ago, and it ended up failing. They realized they really couldn't finance it with their small population and the cost of care, and oftentimes I compare Vermont and say it's kind of like the dog dog that finally caught the car and didn't know what to do with it. Vermont finally was able to pass single payer and kind of didn't know what to do with it and how to finance it. And so now with Washington State getting closer to this type of public option that's a bit different than the Vermont piece, we're going to be looking at how the state will effectively be able to implement this, whether they're going to have the participation from providers that will be required for adequate networks, and whether cost controls that are included in this type of public option will actually be enough to outweigh any of the disruption that is going to go into place to actually implement these methods. And I think that the rest of the country will be looking at this and saying, you know, did this work for Washington State? Was it worth completely upsetting their market to do this? Is there a cost-benefit analysis here? And what can we learn from it?
It's now time for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hours Toast of the Week. Marcy, what are we toasting to?
This week, we're toasting to the provisions that we are in favor for. I just spent a lot of time talking about our opposition to Medicare for All, so I'd like to promote and remind everyone of our talking points of the things that we are asking for to improve the healthcare system, including preserving the employer exclusion, promoting innovation in employer plans, providing employers with relief from burdensome regulations, repealing the taxes from the ACA, and protecting ERISA.
Cheers!
Thank you for joining us for this week's installment of the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. For more information on NAHU's government affairs efforts, or to join as a member of NAHU, visit nahu.org.